Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jane Donahue. Today we bring you a talk from the Maine Historical Society by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Alan Taylor about Maine's role in the American Revolution. In this discussion, which was recorded before a live audience on May 20th at the First Parish Church in Portland, Taylor will deliver a lecture about the life and writings of Joseph Plum Martin, a soldier from Connecticut who fought in the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War. Later, he'll be joined by Maine Historical Society Executive Director Steve Bromage for a conversation about Taylor's roots as a Mainer and his experiences working with Ken Burns on the American Revolution. We begin with an introduction from Maine Historical Society Executive Director Steve Bromage.
Good evening. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. My name is Steve Bromage. I'm the Executive Director of Maine Historical Society. I'd like to welcome all of our Maine Historical Society and Maine Public members, as well as our other guests. We are really thrilled to be able to bring Alan Taylor home to Maine and to spend this evening considering the America's 250th with you. Alan is going to give us a wonderful lecture on Joseph Plum Martin. He and I will then sit and have a conversation about all things 250th. Tonight is really the kickoff keynote for what's going to be a very, very busy year. MHS's year-long initiative, Revolutionary Maine, America 250, is going to engage thousands of people of all backgrounds in every corner of Maine. We have events and programs throughout the state, lots and lots of digital content we're sharing all the time. The real heart, though, of Revolutionary Maine is our upcoming statewide tour of MHS's rare copy of the Dunlap broadside of the Declaration of Independence. We are privileged to steward one of 26 surviving copies of the Dunlap broadside. This is the first printed copy of the Declaration of Independence. So it's not the one with all the fancy signatures and all of that. This is the real one. This copy of the Declaration, which again you'll see up the street at Maine Historical, was printed in Philadelphia on July 4th, 1776. It just blows my mind. So it was printed just hours after ratification and was printed strictly for the purposes to spread word that independence had been declared around the colonies. So from June to October, we're going to be taking the Dunlap broadside to local libraries, museums, schools, and other community organizations in each of Maine's 16 counties. Our goal is to give every Mainer the opportunity to see this sacred national document, to feel that they were personally able to participate in the 250th, and to really encourage reflection on our founding principles. The 250th, of course, comes at quite a moment for our country. On one hand, we are challenged by deep political and cultural divisions. I think many people feel a real sense of crisis, of overwhelming concern about who we are and where we are headed as a nation. On the other, the 250th is a remarkable achievement for a country built on ideals that were revolutionary in 1776 and are every bit remain so today. The Declaration of Independence expressed radical democratic principles that have guided our country and defined American history for 250 years. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And while the Declaration expresses those soaring ideals, they weren't born fully realized. Women, people of color, and indigenous people were all denied basic rights at that time. As a nation, we have been striving to put those ideals into practice for 250 years. Achieving those ideals is our responsibilities as Mainers and Americans. What do those words mean to you? What are our responsibilities as citizens? This year, MHS is asking all Mainers to be part of that conversation. Today, we were just up at Skowhegan interviewing workers at the new Skowhegan sneaker factory and asking them to reflect on those words. It was pretty wonderful and powerful. It's a critical moment to come together and to recognize, celebrate, and build on what we hold in common. And I think at Maine Historical, we really feel that the 250th provides a tremendous opportunity for Mainers to lead, to once again demonstrate our long tradition of independent thinking, respectful dialogue, and standing up for common sense values. So that's to us what the 250th is about. With that, we could not be prouder than to have this opportunity to bring Alan Taylor home to Maine. Alan is originally from Portland, was raised in Windham, and is a 1977 graduate of Colby College. With those Maine roots, he went on to earn his doctorate in American history from Brandeis University and to become one of the country's most esteemed historians. Alan has taught at Boston University, the University of California at Davis, and recently retired from the University of Virginia as the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Chair. Alan is a two-time Pulitzer Prize Award winner and has published 11 books. William Cooperstown won the Bancroft, Beveridge, and Pulitzer Prizes. His second Pulitzer was awarded for The Internal Enemy, Slavery and War in Virginia, 1772 to 1832. Most recently, you likely saw Alan in Ken Burns' American Revolution, which we'll get to in a little bit. Please join me in welcoming Alan Taylor.
Thank you very much, Steve, for that kind introduction and for the invitation to speak here to you all. And I first want to put you at your ease. I am not giving a lecture. This is going to be a fairly informal talk linked to some images that I'll show you. I was talking with Steve before we started the program, and he was talking about the need for security for this copy of the Declaration that's going around. And I'm thinking, well, of course, there's a treasure map on the back of it. I want you to all know that's a joke. Don't go looking for the treasure map. So I've been thinking a lot in the last couple of years about Joseph Plum Martin. And why is that? Well, Joseph Plum Martin wrote the only surviving book-length memoir by an enlisted man in the Continental Army of the American Revolution. And as Steve mentioned, I have been one of the advisors for the Ken Burns film, The American Revolution. And Joseph Plum Martin recurs through there in a pretty consistent fashion, to my great delight. I lobbied hard for that, and that's one of the influences that I did have. And then second, the New York Times Magazine is going to be doing a special issue about the 250th, which is going to be looking at what they call unusual founders, or not the conventional founders. So not the politicians or generals at the top, but ordinary Americans of all sorts who helped to found the United States in that generation. And there too, I lobbied for Joseph Plum Martin. And so they said, well, you're gonna have to write it. So I did. Now, why am I so keen on Joseph Plum Martin? Well, he wrote this book. It is extraordinarily insightful. It's often witty. It is, I think, the best book ever written about the American Revolution. And I say that with some humility because I've written a book about the American Revolution. It was published in Hollowell, Maine in 1830. There was only one edition, which is, we don't have statistics for book publication from then, but if there is, it's not reprinted, it's a suggestion it did not sell well. It's not what people expected. It's not a heroic story. It's not a story of great leaders. It's about the endurance of common soldiers. And there is a lot to endure. So it turns out people weren't that interested in reading about starving, ragged soldiers who have long marches to make, which are much more frequent than heroic battles. But this is the reality of life in the Continental Army. And for me, that was entrancing. And it has become more entrancing over time as people have become more interested in social history, in the ordinary people of the past, in addition to the great leaders of the past. Now, there is a picture that purports to be Joseph Plum Martin and his wife, Lucy Cluley. I don't believe it actually is them. In my opinion, there is no image of Joseph Plum Martin, The Survivor. So that enables me to put this one out there, which is an N.C. Wyeth painting from very early in the 20th century, showing a Continental Army soldier. And he's about the same age, or the right age, I should say, as Joseph Plum Martin, who when he first enlisted was 15 years old. And he'll serve through the war, so he'll be 23 when he's discharged at the end of the war. He's essentially a teenager for most of the time in the war. And this is not uncommon. There were a lot of extremely young people in the Continental Army. Continental Army was desperate for people. Now, this quote is essentially the theme from the book, which is that it's the endurance of the soldiers that won the war. It's not great generalship. It's not great inspired political leadership by Congress. It's that there were enough guys that just hung in there, and we know there were some cross-dressing women as well, that hung in there to the very end and saw this through by enduring these long marches, these encampments filled with sickness, with frostbite, with exposure of all sorts. Hanging in there year after year is what kept the revolution alive. For Martin, the most important episode in his experience was not a particular battle, but it's a mutiny. And by 1779 to 1780, conditions were so bad in the Continental Army that different units would start to mutiny. Now, a mutiny did not mean they're going home or they're deserting to the enemy. It means they're just refusing to take orders. It's a strike, and it's a strike that's driven by their conviction that their commitment to the cause is not being appropriately rewarded. And they're not looking for much. They're looking for decent clothing, some decent shelter, and they're looking for some pay because they go for years without being paid anything. The Continental regiments from Connecticut, and that's where Joseph Plum Martin is originally from. He's from Connecticut. They had a mutiny in May of 1780, in which they just refused to take orders. Some of the officers came along and tried to grab people considered ringleaders to arrest them. The soldiers took their bayonets out and stopped them. But what happens at the end of this mutiny, and the mutiny only lasts about 24 hours, is the soldiers decide they're just going to go back and they made their point. They're going to obey the orders. They're going to continue to endure. And for Martin, that's the key point in the revolution, is that these guys who've suffered everything but death are so committed to one another because of their shared experiences of hardship that they cannot give up and go home. Now, they get somewhat better treatment for a short time after their mutiny, but they will continue to endure until the war is won. When he is discharged, he's not happy because they don't get their back pay. They're given essentially written IOUs from Congress saying that we can't pay you now, but someday in the future we hope we can. This is worth so many dollars. Well, they're almost worthless to these soldiers. They, almost all of them, sold them for pennies on the dollar to get decent enough clothing that they could go back home and appear as respectable people. These written promises from Congress would be redeemed in the early 1790s, but by then the beneficiaries of it were the speculators who bought them up from the soldiers in 1782 to 83. And that's something that just sits really badly with Joseph Plum Martin. So what does he do? He hasn't gotten any pay from his long service. He will go and settle in Maine. And this, a lot of young men who participated in the Continental Army or participated in the Massachusetts militia during the war would go to Maine. Why Maine? It is, by 18th century standards, close, because things move by water better than they move by land. So you could, within a couple of days, get to Penobscot Bay if you're coming from the vicinity of Boston. So these discharged Continental Army soldiers who have basically no money, It's easier for them to get to a frontier experience by sailing down east to Penobscot Bay and vicinity than it is to go west, say, to Ohio. So when Congress did give some soldiers land in Ohio, a lot of them couldn't afford that, and they sold that for pennies on the dollar, and they would end up in Maine instead. And they believed that the land around Penobscot Bay, particularly on the western part of it, what is now Waldo County, had belonged to loyalists and had been confiscated during the Revolution and therefore was free for the taking for former soldiers. That's why Martin goes and settles in what was then the town of Prospect, Maine, but he lives in that part which is now Stockton Springs. And this map, which is not particularly accurate, but it shows the mouth of the Penobscot River, it shows Cape Jellison, where Fort Pownall was located, and it's in that vicinity that he settles. Things don't go entirely well for him, and a primary reason is this man, who's General Henry Knox, who had been George Washington's commander of artillery. And through various legal shenanigans, he manages to get possession of the Waldo patent, which was about 576,000 acres of land. He had married into the family of some loyalists, and then he bought up the rights of other members of the family who had been loyalists. So contrary to the expectations of the soldiers, they will not get free farms. They will have to pay Henry Knox. And when I started doing my own research on this story of Henry Knox and his relationship with the settlers, which was my first book in which much of the research was done in the Maine Historical Society, one of the things I discovered was a protest petition written in 1790 by the settlers of Prospect to the General Court of Massachusetts saying, don't let these loyalist-connected great proprietors have this land. One of the signers to that is Joseph Plum Martin. Now, Martin and his neighbors don't get what they want. General Court of Massachusetts allows Knox to obtain this land monopoly, and Knox will require the settlers to pay him. There's kind of an arbitration process, but it sets the price of $170 for Joseph Plum Martin to buy his farm of 100 acres. Which, of course, that'd be a great bargain today. But that, given the conditions on the Maine frontier at that time, these people are living right on the edge of survival most of the time. $170 they don't generally see. And so Martin's not able to pay it. So he wrote a letter to Henry Knox, and this letter survives. It's in the Henry Knox papers, and I had occasion to stumble upon it in the course of doing my book research. And this is an excerpt from it where Martin is appealing to Knox to show some charity toward him. Knox does not do so. So Joseph Plum Martin will be financially ruined. And by 1818, he's very poor, and he will submit this petition to get a pension from the federal government for his war service, in which he lays out that he doesn't own any land anymore, and all he has is a few livestock, and he has to make his living as a hired laborer. And at the very end of his book, Martin says this, and it gives you the sense that in the society he lived in which people are overwhelmingly small farmers, that land is the key. And he has been frustrated in his aspirations to obtain and keep a farm because the Revolution had not played out in the end in a way that supported his vision of what the Revolution should have been.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk from the Maine Historical Society was recorded live at the First Parish Church in Portland on May 20th. Stay with us as Maine Historical Society Executive Director Steve Bromage joins historian Alan Taylor to ask about his background as a Mainer, his process as a researcher and writer, and his work with documentarian Ken Burns.
We'll come back to Joseph Plum Martin in a couple of minutes, but tell us a little bit, ground us, about growing up in Maine and how you became a historian.
Well, I was born in the mid-1950s, and so I was growing up in the late 1950s and into the 1960s. Maine was a different place than it is now because history is constantly developing. But I really delighted by my family lived in rural settings, particularly once we moved from Windham to Buxton, and I just loved exploring in the woods. And I also just consumed reading history books for kids. My mother would bring me into the Portland Public Library here, and just she had shopping to do, and she just parked me in the library and knew that I'd be perfectly happy and perfectly safe. And I would just read history books until she was ready to pick me up. Now, she was somebody who loved reading. And so she gave me that love of reading, of being able to pursue your curiosity wherever it would lead. And that often led me to the colonial history of Maine and the revolutionary era in Maine. So that was always my passion. But I had no notion that I would be able to pursue this as some sort of professional career, because nobody in my family had ever been a professor anywhere. But that's where it all started. And then I got encouraged along the way by a variety of teachers that kept saying, well, maybe you could take the next step to do something more with it.
You've had a really consistent and remarkable career. Just looking, each of your projects and books has been fascinating. They've contributed to the historiography. What have been the driving passions? You know, how have you gone from project to project? And what have been the passions and interests that have driven your career as a historian?
Well, I remember I would badger my poor parents that on vacations we should go see history sites. Now, it turns out my mother was quite keen to do that, and it turns out my dad was too, well enough. And so we must have seen every fort in the Northeast. And I went to a place called Fort William Henry, which is at the head of Lake George. Now, I don't encourage you to go there today because now it's been turned into a Dungeons and Dragons kind of site. Before then, in its original reconstruction, because it had been destroyed during the Seven Years' War, what's often called the French and Indian War, but it was rebuilt in what I thought was quite an authentic way. And I felt that site did a better job of showing the harsh experiences of common soldiers in the Seven Years' War than anything I'd seen anywhere else. It made such a vivid impression on me. And as a consequence, when I was in the process of becoming a historian, I wanted to do what I thought was a fuller picture. I wanted to tell the story of everybody who got caught up in these great events, including the American Revolution, not just focus on the top leaders. Now, that does not mean that I don't see the importance of the top leaders or don't include them, because I try to, but I try to put it in this social context in which we can see the people who were women and poorer people and middle-class people and enslaved people and native peoples, and see how it all interacts. That's always been my goal.
As Alan suggested, and I was going to say, if you read Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, nothing gives me a more brutal feeling for the conditions on the Maine frontier and how difficult life was. That has always been searing to me. Early in your career, you focused on doing research and writing on Maine, and you used Maine Historical Society as a resource. Can you talk a little bit about just the collections and the resources and how that helped move your career along?
Yeah, I would not be here appearing as a historian with any accomplishments if not for Maine Historical Society. So why do I say that? It's because when I was an undergraduate at Colby College doing a senior thesis, it had to have original research. So the primary place to go was here. And so I cast about and I discovered the William King papers. William King was the first governor of Maine, and he had been a very important politician in Massachusetts before then and an important merchant ship owner. And it's a wonderful collection. Now, when you start out, you have no experience reading these old documents, because they weren't digitized, nothing was online, there were not printed transcripts. It's all late 18th century, early 19th century handwriting. And I had to learn how to read it. And the then curator of manuscripts was a guy named Tom Gaffney, and he took an interest in helping me. This was a time when the Maine Historical Society was a much smaller and very poorly funded operation. And people like Tom, who were committed to the well-being of history and of archives, kept it going through, I think, a pretty dark period for the institution's history. And he helped me understand how to read documents, how to interpret them. And one of the things that I discovered at that time were certain documents that didn't make a lot of sense to me. And it turns out they were letters written by William King to try to obtain licenses so he could trade with the British during the War of 1812, even though the British were the national enemies. Now, those were documents we had to kind of read between the lines to understand what was going on, because documents aren't always transparent at the surface level. And it's with Tom's help, I helped to figure these documents out. And my very first publication is in the Maine Historical Society Quarterly, and it's about those two letters.
Great. Now I'm going to shift gears. And as you know, Mainers get very proud of our native sons who go out into the world. So to me, this has been a really towering year of Mainers out there on the national scene. We've got Cooper Flagg, Rookie of the Year in the NBA. And we have Alan Taylor, who I will make the case stole the show and was the star of Ken Burns' American Revolution.
I would like to have Cooper Flagg's contract.
Well, when we were at New Balance today, I didn't quite get to pull that off for you, but I'll keep working on that.
Then give me a sneaker deal with them?
Yeah, that'd be good. How did your involvement in the Ken Burns Project come to be?
Well, some years ago, I wrote a book called American Revolutions, S at the end of revolution, because the argument of the book is that the revolution was many different things to many different people. So it's a different thing to Henry Knox than it is to Joseph Plum Martin. But they were both involved in the revolution because there was also a common ground that they were fighting for. Having written that book, it came to the attention of one of the producers of the Ken Burns film, and she reached out to me and asked me if I would like to be involved in their advisory committee of scholars and potentially to be interviewed for the film. And I was very happy to be so invited. I've been a great admirer of Ken Burns' films. And I found it to be a very rewarding experience. A great team of advisors were involved in this film, and if you've had occasion to see it, you will know that there are some incredibly articulate, insightful historians who are involved in it. So that's how it all came about. It was a project that I was involved with it for about 6 years. Ken is a real perfectionist. He is really good at raising funds for his films, and it enables him to do documentary historical films at a level of precision and beauty that is practically impossible to match. But it means it takes time. And along the way, there were four screenings of drafts of the film where the advisors would be brought together and we would see them in their 2-hour installments and then have a meeting to discuss them. And every time I'd see it, I'd go, this is a really good film. But then Ken would always say, this is not a finished film. Don't treat it as a finished film. And it would get better every single time we would do this. But the discussions among the scholars and with the filmmakers were an enormous education for me.
That's pretty amazing. What was the highlight of that experience? Excuse me, we were all so
familiar with the Ken Burns Talking Head. Tell us a little bit about where and how those interviews got filmed, and then just what the highlight of the experience was for you.
Well, my interview was filmed in New York City, and they do a lot of their filming in New York City, and because of the PBS station there. Probably the highlight, though, was one of our meetings was at Ken Burns' house in Walpole, New Hampshire. And he has an old barn that he's converted into a very small little studio space. So it was very cramped. We were really quite crowded in there. But it was wonderfully charming. And it happened to be in November. And it was snowing outside. So it could not have been more perfect for us to be sitting in there talking about the experiences of the Continental Army.
So we are... We're in the midst of the 250, with which I mentioned a little before. It's quite a moment for the country. You probably remember the 200th, the bicentennial, pretty well. What's been your kind of perspective if you've watched and thought about and reflected on the 250th, about what this what this moment means to Americans, and how do you kind of get your head around how to think about the 250th?
So we've got 2 hours more to cover. It's obviously a very important question, and there's a reason why there are all of you are in this room. We're all taking stock of where we are as a country, and the revolution is our foundation. And so trying to understand what that generation endured, suffered, and achieved has been important to Americans ever since, including Americans whose ancestors were not there at the time, which is most Americans of today. And I have always found in my career at doing talks with non-academics and general audiences that there is a real commitment by people to try to understand the core principles of our revolution and to try to understand where we are today in relationship to those core principles. Now, Americans obviously don't all agree about anything, except, I think, for this belief that the core principles of the American Revolution define who we should be as Americans. And I think that sense of wanting to understand that has become even more important in the most recent years, when otherwise Americans seem so polarized. So what you're doing and going around with printed copy of the Declaration of Independence, and getting the thoughts of a range of Maine people about its meaning to them in their lives today is, I think, absolutely the best possible thing you could do.
You think about history all the time. Are there...
Sometimes I think about the Red Sox, but,
Well, this year,
been so good this year.
This year, it might be better to think about the 250.
Well, they won yesterday,
everything is fraught, right? Yeah. Ken Burns's film was clearly a tremendous resource. What are other things you are reading or you'd recommend to our audience that we might pay attention to in terms of exhibits, books, conversations, programs that other institutions are doing?
Well, I've written 11 books, so... That'll keep you all busy for a long time. The Ken Burns film, if I'm sure many of you have watched it, and if there's any of the people that you heard speak in that film that you thought said something insightful, and I think there are many people where you'd reach that conclusion, I'd encourage you to go and read their books. So people like Jane Kaminsky or Vincent Brown or Chris Brown, or Maya Jazanov. Maya Jazanov's book on the Loyalists is wonderful. So one of the things that in the course of my career as it's gone on, I've done a lot of work on early Canada, and I have come to appreciate the Loyalists more, and to think that we need to kind of include them at the center of the story as well, and not just think of them as a bunch of losers or a bunch of people who are just stuffed shirts or in Britain's pockets, but as Americans who had a different vision of what America should be. and they lost, but they helped to found Canada. So that Canada is a distinct society today, has a lot to do with the American Revolution, and it should help us understand why people in Canada don't want to be a 51st state.
I'm glad you mentioned the Loyalists, because Eastport, you know, which is right across the border from Canada, that the Loyalist presence right across the bay is a really important part of how they think about this story, and they're clearly very connected there as well.
You're listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's talk from the Maine Historical Society was recorded live at the First Parish Church in Portland on May 20th. Up next, historian Alan Taylor takes audience questions about his work and its relationship to Maine.
I think we'd love to open it up and take some questions.
I'm curious, are there places in Maine that you think are particularly provocative?
Maybe you repeat the question.
Well, I'll repeat the question. The question was, are there particular sites in Maine that are worth going to if you want to get a feeling for the time? I certainly think of Fort Western up in Augusta as being a key site. It's not so much key to the Revolution, but as a kid, I was absolutely fascinated by Fort William Henry at Pemaquid, and I just find the archaeological site there at Pemaquid to be fascinating. So for the colonial era, I would particularly emphasize that. General Peleg Wadsworth built a house right down here, which is, you know, part of the Maine Historical Society campus, and I find that a wonderful place to visit, to get a feel. That was built in the 1780s. So those would be on my short list.
It's interesting. I think in addition to the historic sites, you know, again, just having been in Skowhegan today, I think so much of the story is in the Maine landscape as well. And the Kennebec River played a really important part of Benedict Arnold's march. And we were just observing that, you know, you can see in the landscape why that was so challenging and difficult. So I think that's another way to do it. One of the neat collections we have digitized, those proprietor's collections that Alan mentioned, have been fully digitized and available online. And they have early maps of all of the early land, main land distribution. So I think picking different parts of the state and going around to where some of this happened is another neat way to see it. So the landscape, I would say.
I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more of the story of the proprietors. Starts in as early as the late 17th century and carries on and really into the 19th in some ways. And it seems peculiarly associated with Maine for reasons I don't entirely understand. But could you give us a précis on the great proprietors and how it came about?
I love these invitations to speak for an hour. And you may not be so happy in an hour. So you're right that the phenomenon of the great proprietors is fundamental to understanding Maine's origins. Maine was a contested frontier zone. It's contested between the French in Canada and then the British colonies of New England. And it's a violent place. The native peoples mostly sided with the French, because they saw them as helpful in keeping settlement out. And it created kind of a vacuum where it was possible for different entrepreneurs who had political connections, usually in 17th century England, to get vast tracts of land granted to them, that they're making the promise that they're going to be able to locate settlers on it, which will then create a buffer zone that will protect Massachusetts. And then there are also various more local entrepreneurs along the coast of what is now Lincoln County who were really good at negotiating certain deals with a few Native American leaders to buy deeds from them to very large tracts of land. These deeds are all pretty suspect. It's not always clear that the Native American who signed it had the authority to sell anything. It's not clear what they thought they were selling, but in any case, these people commoditize these deeds to turn them into immense land grants, particularly if you're going up the region up around the Damariscotta River and the Sheepskit River. So those are the reasons why these immense tracts of land had been created. Now, they're created on paper, so the issue is, will courts and political bodies support these documentary claims to vast property, or will they challenge them? Well, it turns out the powers that be of the later 18th century supported the great proprietors in their legal claims to this land. So in most places in Maine, between the Androscoggin River and the Penobscot River, people had to buy their land from a great proprietor. There's a question over here.
I loved your first book. I think it was your first, The Liberty Men and the Great Proprietors.
But you liked the rest of them too, right?
I tried the one on Jefferson's College, and I'm sorry, I just wasn't there for it.
Okay.
But what I see, and I'm sure you see it too, and I'm asking if you, as someone who has studied American politics and American history for your entire career, when I hear about Joseph Plum Martin, and when I look at the news, I see a very long trajectory of our political institutions failing everyone except wealthy white men. Is that accurate? And I guess what I'm asking for, is there any hope? Because we haven't done a good job so far. I mean, there's a start, and then you get a vice president like Andrew Johnson, and then it all goes to hell. Mm-hmm. And that seems the theme to me, is the rich, the rich, the rich, the white, the male, the white. So if you have any words of hope, I would be deeply appreciative.
Okay, well, I have seen one of my roles as doing my best to provide hope. And because there's a lot of hopelessness right now. And it's in many ways, it's across the political spectrum for various reasons. There's no arguing with your premise that the people who've benefited the most in every generation of American history have been the people who have owned the most. But one of my favorite myths remains to this day the story of Pandora's box. And if you remember that myth, all these troubles are unleashed on the world. It's not a particularly, you know, wonderful thing in that a woman is the source of the problems that are unleashed on the world in Pandora's box. But the thing that's left at the end of the box is hope. So I think I find that a very helpful to think about, that no matter how difficult things look, there's always hope, okay? So now that's just a philosophical premise. Now, I do think there have been periods of American history where people have managed to broaden the range of rights. When I compare, now I realize, and I'll confess I'm from the liberal persuasion, if I compare the state of rights in this country right now, while I don't think we're going, you know, in a positive direction currently, if I compare it to what it was like in the mid-1950s in the late 1950s, when I'm watching images of black school children being blasted by fire hoses in the South just for trying to achieve civil rights that had been promised to them by the federal Constitution's amendments of the mid to late 1860s, I compare that, I think things did get a lot better than that, right? There's nothing I have come to conclude from studying American history that the United States is not on some autopilot in any direction, right? It's not on autopilot toward fulfilling greatness. It's not on autopilot toward just delivering inequality. America is what people make of it in the current generation, having to deal with the legacy of the past, which creates the conditions in which they live in. So understanding those conditions, understanding how difficult it is to change things is absolutely important. But nothing is foreordained.
I have a quick question for you. I mean, Joseph Plum Martin's story was told, and I've always been interested. He died, I think, 1830.
1850.
But the story was told. So how did it, given that he was in such poverty and dire straits, how did it make it to paper and that we could all read it today? And how did Yankee Doodle come into this, too? Thank you.
Well, we don't know the inside story of the publication. Because we don't have any other family papers from Joseph Plum Martin. We don't have the original diary, which he must have kept, because the published narrative is so richly detailed about places and times. We don't have any of that. But what must have happened was he must have gone around to newspaper published, because the newspaper publishers of the time were the book publishers. And he, how it was that this one particular publisher in Hollowell ended up publishing it, I don't know. Was it the first publisher he approached? Nobody can tell. But the publisher is then looking at the manuscript and thinking, can I make some money from this? Will it sell well enough that I can recoup my costs? We don't know whether he recouped his costs. Probably not, because there's not another edition that's published until the 1950s. So that's the best I know. Now, as to Yankee Doodle, you're asking about the song? Okay, the song was originally a satiric English song that was written to make fun of colonial soldiers during the Seven Years' War. But it became a point of pride to pick up on this song, because it is a lively song tune, and to turn it against the British by saying, we're actually proud of our provincial mannerisms. So something that had been meant as mockery becomes a source of pride for the patriots of the American Revolution. There's a gentleman over here.
You said, that you wanted to talk to or look at it, the war through the common soldier. And then you made mention about how you felt about the Loyalists. After all of your research, what's the difference? How different do you now look at the Revolutionary War now?
Well, I have developed more of I think the ideal for a historian is to have empathy for everybody that you study. And when you're studying people who are involved in a civil war, that's hard because your own sympathies may lie with one side more than another. But by understanding what the Loyalists fought for and how they were willing to suffer for it, and that they were obliged to rebuild their lives elsewhere, I am much more empathetic for their side of the story. I'm certainly not inclined to cast them as villains. I felt like that there was a popular TV show, Turn, which created the character of John Graves Simcoe as just this bloodthirsty villain. And it's a very Hollywood / American thing to do, to want to have a very stark dichotomy between the good guys and the bad guys. And I've tried to get away from that in thinking about and writing about the American Revolution. And just to try to understand why everybody did whatever they did.
How are you doing, sir? Thank you very much for coming here tonight. I just finished reading the biography of John Adams by David McCullough, and there was a letter from Abigail Adams that I found really striking, because at one point she says, Posterity who are to reap the blessings will scarcely be able to conceive the hardships and sufferings of their ancestors. This really, like I said, it really struck me, it really resonated with me, and I'm just wondering if you can respond to that. Do you find her prophecy essentially to be true?
I think it is true, and it, you know, John Adams said many similar things. He once later in life said, our history of the American Revolution is going to be one continual lie after another. Now, his chief concern was that history wasn't going to recognize that he was the central figure in the revolution, and that too much credit was going to Washington and Franklin. He had this wonderful line in there. He says that the history that was told by the revolution is that Benjamin Franklin smote George Washington with his electrical rod, and that together they marched forth and created the whole revolution. So even in that generation, there was a sense that a myth was developing around the American Revolution. And I will say this, that nations are all built on myths in some way. Now, a myth is something much grander than a lie. A myth is a highly symbolic, selective story that has meaningful values within it. It's something different than the truth, but it's also something different from a lie. And in the wake of the revolution, people want a selective, heroic story. And that has since become both our, you know, our inspiration and our curse, if our goal is to understand just how difficult it was to fight and win the revolution. Because the myth makes it seem like all sensible people agreed on it, when in point of fact, sensible people were on all sides of the issue, and some of them were trying to kill other people. Sophie, there's a person right up here in the very front. But we have cut out the top gallery people.
We'll have to shout. We'll have you shout.
But don't jump.
So I just want to say my takeaway from this talk today about Mr. Martin is that it's a reminder of the power of grassroots. That, I mean, he was just a regular soldier, right? Yeah. Not in government, not anything. But that they, at the time, were willing to do the drudgery work. And that's a big reminder to us today. I mean, this room is full of grassroots people, and we have to do the same thing and carry the same load that he did.
Yeah, which is why I love what Steve's doing to go up and talk with people who work in a New Balance factory, because their perspective on the Declaration is just as important as anybody else's.
Just a question. Is the discussion, or are the did they film when you were critiquing the film, did they record your discussion amongst you historians? Is that available?
Hopefully not all of it. But there is a program that's made, and I think you could probably get it on the PBS website about the making of the film. And there are clips from one of our meetings in there.
Let's take it. Shouting question from above.
A question about the land. You speak about the great proprietors is not allowing Joseph Plum Martin to have land. Are there any places or any areas of Maine where soldiers were able to acquire land, where there were proprietors that honored their service and respected them in a way that they were able to establish small farms and make a good goal?
Well, I would say that even in that broad zone that I talked about, there were people who were able to buy their farms. It's just it's a struggle for them to do it. Not everybody is ruined to the degree that Joseph Plum Martin was ruined. A fair number of people would sell out. They would sell their rights to their farm, to buy their farm to somebody else who is coming along with a bit more money, coming up from Massachusetts with a bit more money. So the settler generation endured these enormous hardships. They don't make much money, but they until they can cash out, and then they would move on elsewhere to the frontier. So there's some of that. Fair number of people who, after being frustrated with the great proprietors, moved over to Eastern Ohio. And I write a little bit about this in the book. There are a few places where the resistance to the great proprietors, I didn't go into that in my talk today, but there are these communities, many of which organize and they dress up as Indians in order to frustrate land surveyors or sheriffs trying to deliver writs of ejectment. It's really quite effective in a number of areas, particularly along the headwaters of the Damariscotta and the Sheepscot River. So in those areas, particularly at the lower reaches of the rivers, they get a settlement that's enforced by the state of Massachusetts, which is much more favorable to the settlers than is the case elsewhere. So there's a whole range of experiences. I would just argue that a majority of the settlers in Maine did not get anything close to the free land that they thought they would get. Now, I want to emphasize, I'm not describing all of Maine, so as people will mention to me, there are some towns in northernmost Maine where the state of Massachusetts provided free land to some veterans. Yes, that did happen. But the region that I'm talking about, which is between the Penobscot River and the Androscoggin River, that did not happen.
Hi, Al. Could you speak to the reintegration of the Loyalists and if there are any lessons there for us today?
Well, I think there are always lessons of letting political bygones be bygones and to try to patch things up. And it is true that a lot of the Loyalists by the 1790s felt that it would be safe to come back. And they reintegrate into American society. They tended to keep a low profile and just fit in and go about their business and not be involved in politics anymore. So that phenomena did happen.
Thank you so much for coming this evening, and let's just give a huge thank you to Al.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program featured a talk from the Maine Historical Society by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Alan Taylor. It was recorded in front of an audience at the First Parish Church in Portland on May 20th. You can find this episode and many other on-demand programs on our website at mainepublic.org. Click on Shows to find Speaking in Maine, including this episode. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.